Chapter 135. Wilson gives U.S. the cut departure for Imeo. About 3 weeks after the Julia sailing, our conditions began to be a little precarious. We were without any regular supply of food. The arrival of ships was growing less frequent. And, what was worse yet, all the natives, but good old Captain Bob, began to tire of us. Nor was this to be wondered at. We were obliged to live upon their benevolence, when they had little enough for themselves. Besides, we were sometimes driven to acts of marauding, such as kidnapping pigs, and cooking them in the groves, at which their proprietors were by no means pleased. In this state of affairs, we determined to march off to the consul in a body, and, as he had brought us to these straits, demand an adequate maintenance. On the point of starting, Captain Bob's men raised the most outrageous cries, and tried to prevent us. Though hitherto we had strolled about wherever we pleased, this grand conjunction of our whole force, upon one particular expedition, seemed to alarm them. But we assured them that we were not going to assault the village, and so, after a good deal of gibberish, they permitted us to leave. We went straight to the Pritchard residence, where the consul dwelt. This house, to which I have before referred, is quite commodious. It has a white veranda, glazed windows, and other appurtenances of a civilized mansion. Upon the lawn in front are palm trees standing erect here and there, like sentinels. The consular office, a small building by itself, is enclosed by the same picket which fences in the lawn. We found the office closed, but, in the veranda of the dwelling house, was a lady performing a tonsorial operation on the head of a prim-looking, elderly European, in a low, white cravat, the most domestic little scene I had witnessed since leaving home. Bent upon an interview with Wilson, the sailors now deputed the doctor to step forward as a polite inquirer after his health. The pair stared very hard as he advanced. But no ways disconcerted, he saluted them gravely, and inquired for the consul. Upon being informed that he had gone down to the beach, we proceeded in that direction, and soon met a native, who told us that, apprised of our vicinity, Wilson was keeping out of the way. We resolved to meet him, and passing through the village, he suddenly came walking toward us. Having apparently made up his mind that any attempt to elude us would be useless. "What do you want of me, you rascals?" he cried, a greeting which provoked a retort in no measured terms. At this juncture, the natives began to crowd round, and several foreigners strolled along. Caught in the very act of speaking to such disreputable acquaintances, Wilson now fidgeted, and moved rapidly toward his office, the men following. Turning upon them incensed, he bade them be off. He would have nothing more to say to us. And then, hurriedly addressing Captain Bob in Tahitian, he hastened on, and never stopped till the postern of Pritchard's wicket was closed behind him. Our good old keeper was now highly excited, bustling about in his huge petticoats, and conjuring us to return to the Calabooza. After a little debate, we acquiesced. This interview was decisive. Sensible that none of the charges brought against us would stand, yet unwilling formally to withdraw them, the consul now wished to get rid of us altogether, but without being suspected of encouraging our escape. Thus only could we account for his conduct. Some of the party, however, with a devotion to principle truly heroic, swore they would never leave him, happen what might. For my own part, I began to long for a change, and as there seemed to be no getting away in a ship, I resolved to hit upon some other expedient. But first, I cast about for a comrade, and of course the long doctor was chosen. We at once laid our heads together, and for the present, resolved to disclose nothing to the rest. A few days previous, I had fallen in with a couple of Yankee lads, twins, who, originally deserting their ship at Tanning's Island, an uninhabited spot, but exceedingly prolific in fruit of all kinds, had, after a long residence there, roved about among the society group. They were last from Imeo, the island immediately adjoining, where they had been in the employ of two foreigners who had recently started a plantation there. These persons, they said, had charged them to send over from Papeete, if they could, two white men for field laborers. Now, all but the prospect of digging and delving suited us exactly, but the opportunity for leaving the isle, and was not to be slighted, and so we held ourselves in readiness to return with the planters, who, in a day or two, were expected to visit Papeete in their boat. At the interview which ensued, we were introduced to them as Peter and Paul, and they agreed to give Peter and Paul $15 a month, promising something more should we remain with them permanently. What they wanted was men who would stay to elude the natives, many of whom, not exactly understanding our relations with the consul, might arrest us, were they to see us departing. The coming midnight was appointed for that purpose. When the hour drew nigh, we disclosed our intention to the rest. Some upbraided us for deserting them, others applauded, and said that, on the first opportunity, they would follow our example. At last, we bade them farewell, and there would now be a serene sadness in thinking over the scene, since we never saw them again, had not all been dashed by G's picking the doctor's pocket of a jackknife, in the very act of embracing him. We stole down to the beach, where, under the shadow of a grove, the boat was waiting. After some delay, we shipped the oars, and pulling outside of the reef, set the sail, and with a fair wind, glided away for Imeo. It was a pleasant trip. The moon was up, the air warm, the waves musical, and all above was the tropical night, one purple vault hung round with soft, trembling stars. The channel is some 5 leagues wide. On one hand, you have the three great peaks of Tahiti lording it over ranges of mountains and valleys, and on the other, the equally romantic elevations of Imeo, high above which a lone peak, called by our companions the Marling Pike, shot up its verdant spire. The planters were quite sociable. They had been seafaring men, and this, of course, was a bond between us. To strengthen it, a flask of wine was produced, one of several which had been procured in person from the French admiral's steward, for whom the planters, when on the former visit to Papeete, had done a good turn by introducing the amorous Frenchman to the ladies ashore. Besides this, they had a calabash filled with wild boar's meat, baked yams, breadfruit, and tomba's potatoes. Pipes and tobacco also were produced, and while regaling ourselves, plenty of stories were told about the neighboring islands. At last we heard the roar of the Imeo Reef, and gliding through a break, floated over the expanse within, which was smooth as a young girl's brow, and beached the boat. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.